This is the Music History In-Depth podcast for April 30th through May 7th. On this week's show, we delve deep into Mozart's The Marriage of Figaro, we discuss a tale of two men during the Payola scandal, Clapton and Bowie inspire the Rock Against Racism concert, and we celebrate the life of the godfather of soul, Mr. James Brown. This show goes more in depth about some of the events that we put on our daily podcast, the Music History Today podcast, which drops every single day, including weekends, wherever you get your podcast from. Now, on to this week's episode. Our first story concerns a guy by the name of Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. On May 1st, 1786, Mozart premiered his opera, The Marriage of Figaro. The opera was the first of three collaborations between Mozart and Lorenzo da Ponte, who wrote the libretto for him. The other collaborations between the two of them included the piece Don Giovanni, by the way. The libretto is actually based on a stage comedy called The Mad Day, which had premiered only 2 years earlier in 1784. Now, to put this into the United States timeline for you, the Revolutionary War was over and out in 1783, and the United States Constitution wasn't written and approved until 1787 and 1788, respectively. So all of what was going on over in Austria with the Marriage of Figaro actually went down just after the U.S. Revolution, or rather in between the Revolution and the Constitution being done, just so you get your brain into the right time frame here. Now, to break the storyline down for you in just a basic way, the opera is about Figaro and Susanna, who had fallen in love with each other. Problem, though, both of them were employed by the Count Almaviva, who was actually himself married and had a thing for Susanna because, of course, why not? It's an opera. And, oh, by the way, of course, he tried to seduce her. In this day and age, that would be considered sexual harassment. Back in that day and age, though, not so much. In any event, Susanna and Figaro do get married, and in the process, they make sure that the Count learns a very valuable lesson about infidelity. The Count does end up having feelings again for his wife, and, you know, to quote Shakespeare, all's well that ends well. The opera premiered at the Burg Theater in Vienna with an initial 9 performances, but the opera was a huge critical success. And as time went on, it was changed and adjusted for the voices of whoever was performing it at that point. To this day, it is actually one of the top 10 operas in terms of numbers of performances worldwide. As far as Mozart went, he continued being the classical rock star that he was for another 5 years until his untimely death at the age of 35 after a brief illness. Of course, after his death, as with all great artists, his reputation grew and he became who he is known as today, which is being one of the greatest classical composers of all time, right up there with Bach and Beethoven. The premiere of Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart's timeless opera, The Marriage of Figaro, May 1st, 1786. This next story is a tale of two men. One was a famous disc jockey named Alan Freed, who many credit with bringing rock and roll to the white audiences, or at least the mainstream, we'll say. The other is TV host and businessman Dick Clark, who had a long-running music show called American Bandstand. This is also a cautionary tale about how to handle yourself during a scandal. This particular scandal's events concluded in a hearing that was held on May 2nd, 1960. You see, back in the 1950s, there was a little something known as payola. It was where radio stations and other people in the record industry would get paid to play certain songs, the old school version of pay to play, quite literally. It was also very much illegal, being a violation of the sponsorship identification rules that the Federal Communications Commission put out. They said that you could get paid to play the songs, but you had to mention it, and it had to be treated like an advertisement, or as they say, sponsored airtime. The payola problem started long before Dick Clark and Alan Freed started messing with the system. The radio and TV show Your Hit Parade never really said how they were figuring out all their charts, other than to put out a release saying that it was based on, quote, readings of radio requests, sheet music sales, dance hall favorites, and jukebox tabulations, end quote. Some people actually took it a step further and got their names put on certain hit records as songwriters just so they could take a cut of the profits, even though they had nothing to do with the writing of the song. Enter Dick Clark, who at that time held a lot of power as the host of American Bandstand, right up until, let's say somewhere in the late 60s, 70s or so, when another show named Soul Train came along. American Bandstand was one of the few TV shows worldwide that was devoted to teenage culture and pop music. That show broke a lot of artists, so getting seen on the show was a huge deal. Well, Dick, like a lot of people, saw this more as a golden opportunity to make some serious cashola, and things went extremely well for him in that department. Now, you have Cleveland disc jockey Alan Freed, who was basically doing the exact same thing. His musical endeavors were helping him gain influence and made him a lot of money in the process as well. And as with everything, things were going great until the federal government started frowning on all of it. So the feds decided to call the House Committee on Legislative Oversight and expose the practice in front of the entire nation. Granted, Congress was egged on by music publishers who saw these payola deals as eating into their profits, so they twisted Congress's arms. The whole affair, which became known as the payola scandal, was a huge deal. DJ after DJ were dragged in front of Congress. One DJ, Phil Lind of WAIT Radio in Chicago, Illinois, admitted to taking $22,000 to play a song. That's $22,000 in that era's money. Soon, both Clark and Freed were brought in front of the committee. Clark finished his testimony on May 2, 1960. Both men denied the charges of illegally profiting off of the artists. Here's the thing, though. See, Clark had earlier divested himself from all of the bad business dealings by the time he was brought in front of the committee. That meant having to give up ownership of 33 different record labels. That's 33. Of course, he didn't do this willingly. His bosses at ABC Television Network, who ran American Bandstand, made him do it. While in front of Congress, however, he was polite and extremely cooperative in explaining how he made $31,700 profit from a $125 investment in one record label alone. Clark said, quote, "Believe me, this is not as unusual as it may seem. I think the crime I have committed, if any, is that I made a great deal of money in a short time on little investment. But that is the record business," end quote. While Clark was smooth-talking and slick with the congressman, Alan Freed, not so much. He was extremely uncooperative and bombastic and, above all, arrogant. And in the end, on May 2, 1960, Congress gave Dick Clark the pass, and it was Alan Freed who got into trouble. Now, Dick Clark would go on to remain host of American Bandstand, which ran right up until somewhere into the 90s, and of course, he ended up doing his famous bloopers and practical joke show, all of his game shows like the $25,000 Pyramid, and his New Year's Rockin' Eve show and the American Music Awards, etc., etc., building up his business empire into a behemoth, but a more legit behemoth. Meanwhile, Alan Freed lost his entire career, never recovered, mainly because of his not cooperating or even trying to make amends for a practice that some would say has only really mutated into something barely legal at this point in time, like, oh, say, people having to pay to be put on certain popular playlists on streaming platforms. You know who you are. Just saying. In the end, though, Alan Freed died an early death at the age of 43 from alcoholism. Of course, record labels found other ways to curry favor in order to get this all done. They started using third-party companies to get their records played by any means necessary. And I do mean by any means necessary. Since Congress stripped DJs of making programming decisions, that left the programming directors with all of the power, which meant doing things like buying more commercial airtime on the station in exchange for more airplay for certain songs. These days, payola's taken on a murky yet not really murky form of paying or giving perks to the really popular playlists on certain streaming sites, sometimes still called pay-to-play. Build a better mousetrap, and a bigger mouse will come along and knock it over. The conclusion of the congressional payola testimony with the testimony of Dick Clark on May 2nd, 1960. Before we go any further, we'd like to tell you about our other podcasts. The Music History Today podcast goes over the daily events in music history and drops daily, including weekends, on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts. There's also the Music Halls of Fame podcast, which talks about a member of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, along with other Music Halls of Fame's museums and walks of fame. The Music Halls of Fame podcast drops every Thursday and can also be found on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to this podcast. Forgiving celebrities for past transgressions is something that's always fascinated me. We easily forgive some while we revile others. I'll give you some examples. O.J. Simpson, the late great O.J. Simpson now, continues to be vilified for the double murder and armed robbery issues, while basketball player Kobe Bryant is looked at as a legend, but rarely are marital infidelities and his rape trial ever mentioned. Now, it could be that it involves the severity of the situation. However, Jay-Z went to trial for assault and no one ever brings it up except when singing H to the Izzo, which has his trial in the lyrics. Not guilty, y'all got to feel me. Mel Gibson is back in everyone's good graces, even though he was caught screaming at his family with some not so nice things to say, including Mel making several racist remarks. Chris Brown is still getting award nominations and selling records, even though he's had a large number of legal issues, including the alleged abuse of Rihanna. Even Mr. I Love Nazis Kanye, or Ye, or whatever he's calling himself at this particular time, is getting number one records, despite all of his issues, and there's an awful lot of them. See? Land of second chances. I bring this all up because this story has to do with three topics that are relevant to today's political climate: racism, immigration, and second chances. And it all has to do with music. What if I told you that two of the most revered artists of the past 80 years or so both made racist remarks that lit the fuse and pissed off enough people that an organization was actually started to help combat them, which culminated in an iconic ad hoc concert? First, let's throw some context into this whole thing so you don't think that this is just a far-right Donald Trump Brexit vote or refugee crisis type of thing. Back in 1968, a British Conservative Member of Parliament named Enoch Powell gave what he called the Birmingham Speech, but it is now more well known as the River of Blood Speech. In it, Powell criticized people from British Commonwealth member countries like Jamaica immigrating to England, along with criticizing a bill making its way through Parliament at the time called the Race Relations Bill. Full disclosure, my mother was one of those people, along with several of my family members, who immigrated to England from Jamaica back in the 1950s and 60s. They were known as the Windrush Generation, named after one of the first ships that brought immigrants to England called the Windrush. That's right, people. I was actually born in England, despite the fact that I have no English accent. I moved to America with my parents. But England was where my parents met. My dad was an American military member. We didn't stay in England that long after I was born, about 5 years before coming to America, but I do have dual citizenship because of it. Anyway, the speech, the River of Blood speech, was seen as being rather divisive. When he was talking about member countries, he was not referring to places like Australia or Canada, who are also part of the British Commonwealth. He was referring to people who had, let's just say, darker complexions, especially the countries with people who had darker complexions. Any of this sounding a lot like today's political climate? Yeah. We never seem to learn from history, do we? At that time, there was and still is a political party in England called the National Front. Think of them as the British version of the Ku Klux Klan, but as a political party. In the 1970s, thanks to Powell and people like him, the National Front were feeling pretty powerful. They held violent protests and beat up black people on the streets at will, and also without much interference from the police. Any black people, or any other ethnic minority for that matter, really, it didn't matter to these people. They even went to concerts with black musicians and went up on stage and beat the black artists up while they were performing. To be black and to perform in England in the 1970s literally meant risking your life. In the mid-1970s, feeling that the time was right to push his agenda yet again, Enoch Powell decided again to run for high office. During his run, he received a surprise endorsement of sorts. Enter guitar god Eric Clapton. Yeah, that Eric Clapton. In 1976, Clapton performed a concert in Birmingham, England. During the concert, at which he was drunk, he threw his support behind Powell and said that England was, quote, overcrowded, end quote, and that Powell would stop England from becoming, quote, a black colony, end quote. Clapton then said that England should, quote, get the foreigners out, get the wogs out. Side note, by the way, wog is a racial slur in England for blacks, Middle Eastern, and Southeastern Asian people, in case you should ever hear it in your travels. Back to the quote. And get the coons out, end quote. He then started chanting, Keep Britain White, which is the slogan of the National Front. Not to be outdone, another rock legend decided in multiple interviews to step into the mix. In interviews with Playboy and other publications, David Bowie showed support for fascism. He said, quote, Britain is ready for a fascist leader. I think Britain could benefit from a fascist leader. After all, fascism is really nationalism. I believe very strongly in fascism. People have always responded with greater efficiency under a regimental regime and leadership. End quote. He also called Hitler the first real rock star. Clapton and Bowie later apologized for their remarks, with Clapton finally doing it in 2018, a full 42 years after the fact. Better late than never, I guess. Both Clapton and Bowie blamed drug and alcohol use, among other things, although even as late as 2007, Clapton still supported Powell's cause and didn't think that Powell was a racist. boy, does this sound like the statements coming out of people's mouths after that white nationalist parade in Charlottesville, Virginia a few years back, or what? Now, the fact that Clapton played blues music, which was primarily black music, was not lost on more than a few people, including Red Saunders, who wrote a letter to British music magazine NME, in which he states that Clapton's comments were, quote, all the more disgusting because he had his first hit, solo hit that is, with a cover of reggae star Bob Marley's I Shot the Sheriff. Come on, Eric, own up. Half your music is black. Who shot the sheriff, Eric? It sure as hell wasn't you. End quote. This letter, by the way, wasn't just some angry whining. It ended with a call to arms. In that same letter to the editor, Saunders called for a group to be put together called Rock Against Racism. The response was so good that on August 29th, 1976, Rock Against Racism was formed by Saunders, Roger Huddle, among other people. The mission of the group was to promote unity and love and to get kids to not embrace racism. The group started to do concerts with multicultural acts and do marches at the same time. It wasn't a national organization. It was more of a ragtag group of local units in different cities doing their own things, but with a common goal. On April 30th, 1978, the London branch of Rock Against Racism put on a concert at Victoria Park in London. They were first going to gather at Trafalgar Square and then march to Victoria Park for a rally and music festival. Organizers expected, at best, maybe 10,000 people. They got over 100,000. As they marched to the concert, they chanted slogans such as, Black and white, unite and fight. The group was so large that even the National Front members who were in the area to start problems had to literally run and hide. The music festival itself was a do-it-yourself event. Volunteers put the stage together. Electricity flow was so bad that sometimes the instruments faded in and out. The Clash were the headliners, with Steel Pulse and other groups filling in the undercard. It's one of those concert events that's taken on a legend of its own and is still celebrated to this day as the day England finally stood up against racism. Okay, at least for a little while. As far as Rock Against Racism went, the group has been active and inactive over the years. Honestly, it seems like now would be the perfect time for it to become very active again. Now, let's circle back to what started this whole organization getting together to begin with. What became of Clapton's and Bowie's reputations after all this? Well, once they apologized, they were basically forgiven. In fact, if I hadn't have brought this all up, you probably would never have known about this because honestly, I did not until I started researching this event way back when. Now I'm honestly not quite sure how I feel about them, to be very truthful. I used to love David Bowie. Still do. Love his music. For starters, blaming any of your thoughts on drugs and alcohol has always been a really lame excuse, in my opinion. Sure, you can blame them for your actions, but not for your actual thoughts. Those words, after all, came from their heads and their hearts, not from a bottle, not from a syringe, not from a pill. Much to think about. In Bowie's case, he also said that he was in a different state of being at that time and had been into the occult and was reading a lot of fascist literature, but saw how wrong he was. He went about changing his ways, bringing more ethnic minorities into the spotlight, including helping to give a guy by the name of Luther Vandross a spotlight by writing songs with him, and with Luther singing backup vocals on the song Young Americans. He famously went after MTV in an interview for not playing black artists on their channel in the early 1980s. Clapton, though, never really did much to make amends, other than an apology 42 years later. I could be wrong about that, but to date, other than playing music with black artists, which he was already doing anyway, I haven't found much in terms of him reaching out. These days, though, no one makes much attention or mention of either Clapton or Bowie's past comments, so people forgive, or at least they forget. All right, not everybody. See, the reaction to OJ's death lately as evidence of anybody forgiving or forgetting that guy. In any event, at least some good did come from all of this when the Rock Against Racism concert with The Clash headlining took place in Victoria Park in London, England on April 30th, 1978. It is time to do an honorable mention, and this honorable mention is a major birthday. This major birthday is for the godfather of soul, soul brother number one, the hardest working man in show business, Mr. Dynamite, the sex machine, the minister of the new super heavy funk, the one and only Mr. James Brown, who probably has almost as many nicknames as Shaquille O'Neal. If you were to draw a musical family tree as to influential artists and the artists that they had influenced, then you would start with Chuck Berry, Elvis Presley, The Beatles, Little Richard, and The Rolling Stones. You should also make a completely different chart for James Brown. I mean, who didn't this guy influence? From Prince to Michael Jackson to Otis Redding to Parliament Funkadelic, the list goes on and on and on, even to this very day. Most artists are an offshoot in some way, shape, or form of James Brown. He had actually started out working on the streets, but he didn't hone his skills in school like a lot of musical artists back in the day. He ended up spending some time in jail as a kid for stealing things out of parked cars, and it was in jail that he actually honed his skills by singing gospel, which actually ended up getting him out of jail early, literally. He gained success as part of the famous Flames in the late 50s before going solo, and as much as his music was beginning to get people's attention, what really got him attention were his live shows. From his signature dancing, sliding across the floor, the cape around the shoulder, strutting across the stage, putting on marathon concerts, along with putting out hits like Papa's Got a Brand New Bag, Try Me, I Feel Good, Sex Machine, The Big Payback, Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud, and that list just keeps going and going and going. His involvement in the civil rights movement actually gained him the respect in the black community. For example, during the night of Martin Luther King's assassination, James performed a concert in Boston, Massachusetts that was televised on local television, and it's actually credited as being one of the major reasons why Boston did not have a riot that night. James also campaigned for educational causes, taught self-reliance, and was involved in other political causes right up until his death from heart failure on Christmas Day 2006. His personal life was, to be really nice about it, spotty at best. From his marriages, his infidelity, his drug abuse, his domestic abuse, and numerous stints in jail, just to get that started. He definitely kept the tabloids busy. His talent and influence, however, cannot ever be denied by anybody. And it all started when he breathed his very first breath on May 3rd, 1933. Back in the 1950s, the city of Los Angeles had an idea for a Walk of Fame. The idea for the walk was dreamed up by E.M. Stewart, who was president of the Hollywood Chamber of Commerce in 1953. People think that the idea for having stars came from the Hollywood Hotel, which had stars on the ceiling in their dining room. The final parameters for the project were agreed upon in 1955 and presented to the Los Angeles City Council in 1956. Construction for the Walk of Fame started in 1958 and ended in 1960. Now, right around the time that construction and planning for the Walk of Fame was going on, some committee members who worked in the music industry realized that a lot of people who were involved in music would never get a star on the Walk of Fame. The walk was for the marquee names, you know, the singers, the musicians, the glamour squad, if you will. There were tons of other people who worked just as hard behind the scenes who also deserved an award of some sort. Those executives decided to hold an award ceremony. They had seen the Academy Awards for motion pictures grow in popularity and wanted some of that shine for their industry. They just weren't sure what to call it. At first, they were going to call it the Eddie, after the inventor of the phonograph, Thomas Edison. In the end, they opted to name the awards not after a person, but Emil Berliner's invention called the gramophone. Hence the name, the Grammys. Next up came the trophy. The executives decided to shape the award like a gramophone, and in 1990, the awards got a bit of a makeover, including using a zinc alloy instead of a soft lead one, in order to make them more durable. Billings Artworks in Ridgeway, Colorado makes the awards. As for the ceremony itself, it has mainly been held in Los Angeles and New York City on occasions, although it's also bounced around sometimes, making its way to places like Nashville and Chicago. The first Grammy Awards took place on May 4th, 1959, and awarded music that came out in 1958. There were two ceremonies that were held, one in Los Angeles at the Beverly Hilton Hotel and one in New York City at the Park Sheridan Hotel. There were a couple of other things that made this different from the following years. The first was that this was the only year where the ceremony was not televised. Up until the early 1970s, though, they weren't even carried live like they are today. Also, only three of the Big Four awards, as they're known as today, were handed out at the very first ceremony. Best New Artist didn't come into existence until the second ceremony. There were 22 awards handed out during the first year. The categories were general, children's, comedy, composing and arranging, country, jazz, musical show, packaging and notes, pop, production and engineering, R&B, and spoken. As far as the big winners, Ella Fitzgerald, Count Basie, Domenico Modugno, and Ross Bagdasarian, famous for the Alvin and the Chipmunks comedy albums, each won two awards. Henry Mancini also won two awards, including Album of the Year. Overall, throughout Grammy history, Henry Mancini won 20 Grammys. The winners for the categories, in case you were curious, were: for Record of the Year, Volare from Domenico Modugno was the winner. He was up against Perry Como for Catch a Falling Star, Peggy Lee with Fever, David Seville and the Chipmunks with The Chipmunk Song, and Frank Sinatra for Witchcraft. Album of the Year, as I mentioned before, was won by Henry Mancini, but it was for a TV show, the music from Peter Gunn. Van Cliburn was also up for Tchaikovsky Concerto No. 1 in B-flat minor, Opus 23. Ella Fitzgerald was up for Ella Fitzgerald Sings the Irving Berlin Songbook. Frank Sinatra actually had two entries in Album of the Year that year. He lost out probably because he split the vote. The albums, by the way, were Come Fly With Me and Only the Lonely. Song of the Year was won by, well, Domenico Modugno for Volare. He was also up against Perry Como for Catch a Falling Star, Vic Damone for Gigi, Peggy Lee for Fever, and Frank Sinatra for Witchcraft. Best Recording for Children was by David Seville and the Chipmunks for The Chipmunk Song. Best Comedy Performance was also The Chipmunk Song. Composing and Arranging was Nelson Riddle for Cross Country Suite. Meanwhile, Best Arrangement itself was won for the music from Peter Gunn by Henry Mancini. In country, Best Country and Western Performance was the Kingston Trio for Tom Dooley. Best Jazz Performance by an Individual was Ella Fitzgerald. Best Jazz Performance by a Group was Count Basie. Best Musical Show, the original cast album for The Music Man. Best Soundtrack Album, by the way, was for Gigi. In Packaging and Notes, Best Album Cover Photography was Frank Sinatra for Frank Sinatra Sings for Only the Lonely. In Pop, Best Female Vocal Performance went to Ella Fitzgerald. Best Male Vocal Performance went to Perry Como. Best Vocal Group or Chorus Performance went to Keely Smith and Louis Prima for That Old Black Magic. Best Performance by a Dance Band went to Count Basie. Best Performance by an Orchestra went to Billy May for Billy May's Big Fat Brass. Production and Engineering for Non-Classical went to The Chipmunk Song again. Best for Classical went to Sherwood Hall III for Duets with Spanish Guitar. In R&B, Best Rhythm and Blues Performance went to The Champs for the classic Tequila. In Spoken Word, Best Performance Documentary or Spoken Word went to Stan Freberg for the Best of the Stan Freberg Shows. The awards have had plenty of controversy over the decades. They've been accused of showcasing crass corporate commercialism. They've also been accused of being grossly out of step and behind the times, because a lot of their voting bloc, up until very recently, was mainly made up of people 60 years old and over. It showcased both of those accusations rather profusely. The corporate commercialism part has been shown by giving the top honors to artists such as Natalie Cole, Nora Jones, Tony Bennett, and other artists who your grandparents would like instead of cutting-edge critically acclaimed artists that you would probably like. Other times, they've done stupid things like giving the first heavy metal album award to Jethro Tull, who are not even remotely a heavy metal band at all. They actually beat out, among others, Metallica that year. Go figure. They don't call the awards the Grammy Awards for nothing. The Recording Academy, who runs the awards, have also been accused of racism by doing such things as putting Drake into the rap category for the song Hotline Bling, even though that song is definitely not a rap song by anyone's stretch of the imagination. Drake had figured that the Academy did that because of the color of his skin. He was unfortunately not wrong. Still others point to Macklemore and Ryan Lewis winning the Best Rap Album category over Kendrick Lamar's more critically acclaimed album as proof of the Academy voters' racist attitudes when it comes to preferring white hip-hop artists over black ones. Again, those critics probably aren't wrong. Maybe? Don't know. A more recent controversy has been over the Academy's treatment of women, both concerning the awards and also concerning their own organization. During the 60th annual award ceremony, which was held in 2018, it was pointed out that despite all the great work that female artists have done, in the six ceremonies before that, only 9% of the nominations went to female artists. When Academy President Neil Portnoy was asked about it, rather than say anything about streamlining the process, he instead blurted out that women needed to, quote, step up, end quote. The result was a public relations disaster that resulted in Portnoy losing his job and being replaced by new CEO Deborah Dugan. In 2020, 10 days before the award ceremony for that year, Dugan was suspended from her position after the Academy said that a staff complaint was filed against her for bullying. Deborah then went on the offensive. First, she filed a multi-million-dollar lawsuit against the Academy for discrimination. Among the many charges that she brought up was that the reason why she was suspended was because she couldn't do the reforms that she wanted due to forces that were still loyal in the Academy to Neil Portnoy. Next, she and her lawyer went on a public relations blitz, hitting every talk show that they could just before the ceremony was supposed to take place. During those interviews, she made the accusation that the voting process was actually rigged. For its part, the Academy revamped its voting process to have less conflicts of interest, along with adding a diversity leader and inviting younger, more diverse voters into its ranks. Another bit of controversy concerning the awards concerns the time of eligibility. The award's eligibility time frame usually runs from October 1st of one year to September 30th of the next. Some people say that that means that music that comes out for the holiday season period won't be in the voters' heads when it comes time to vote the next year. They want the awards to have a later cutoff period of either November or December. Can't say as I blame them, to be honest with you. Makes perfect sense. The first Grammy Award ceremony, which was held on May 4th, 1959. That is it for the Music History In-Depth podcast for April 30th through May 7th. Thanks for listening.